In 2020, Rear Admiral Bruce Gillingham, the Surgeon General of the Navy, launched a professional reading list of books that have helped shape his perspective as a doctor, naval officer, and leader over the course of 3 decades of service. Each book corresponds with one of Navy medicine's priorities and are categorized under people, platforms, performance, or power. To strengthen understanding of these priorities and the application of reading lists to Navy medicine, Rear Admiral Gillingham began a special conversation series with the book's authors in November 2020. The following is a recording of a conversation that took place on February 14, 2022 with retired Admiral James Stavridis, the author of The Sailor's Bookshelf, 50 Books to Know the Sea.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our most recent installment of the SG's Conversation with Authors. Today, we're fortunate to have our first repeat author, Admiral James Stavridis. And just as a reminder of kind of the genesis of this, opportunity, as I took over as a Surgeon General 2.5 years ago, I felt it would be a great opportunity to share some of the books that I've read that have made an impact on me, both professionally, both as a naval officer and a physician, but also that have led to contributed to my development as a leader. And so that was the SG's reading list, and we felt a great way to expand and popularize the SG's reading list, which I will hasten to add is not homework, but opportunity. Would be to have conversations with authors that have books on that SG's reading list. And we've been very fortunate to have Admiral Stavridis, as I've said, twice now. We look forward to a discussion today about his most recent book, The Sailor's Bookshelf, 50 Books to Know at Sea. This is a reflection of two of his three loves, the first, of course, being for his family, his wife and daughters, and now grandchildren. Congratulations, Admiral. And as well, that in this case, his love of the sea and his love of reading. And so before we dive in, I've asked Admiral Stavridis to spend just a couple of moments telling us how he finds so much time to read, given clearly his very busy schedule, in that he is a principal with the Carlyle Group, managing director, I understand, contributes really prolifically to generating columns for national publications, including Time Magazine, and as we know, writes almost continuously books. So, with that, Admiral, over to you, and any strategies for those who are listening today on how they can increase the time they spend reading?
Sure. Well, first, thanks for having me on again. You said a repeat author. Some would say repeat offender, but I'm glad to be on with a fellow reader, a fellow lover of books, and a fellow sailor, Admiral. So here's always been my approach is organize, prioritize, and use technology to help you. The third one has been kind of an add-on later on. But organize, all I mean by that is find the time in the day, even if it's only 5 or 10 minutes. I think a big fallacy is, oh, I'll never get a chance to read because I've got to sit down and I got to have like 2 hours in front of a crackling fireplace with my basset hound at my feet. And that's the only time I can really read. You got to give that up. You got to find the pockets of time and sort of organize and be ready to go with a book. And that used to be harder. I used to, kind of go everywhere I went with my briefcase, wherever I'd have a book in it. But now, of course, you can read very effectively on your smartphone. And if you don't have a Kindle account on your smartphone, on your iPad, and on your laptop, you're missing the chance to organize yourself. And that's part of the technology piece of this. It's become so much easier. In terms of when you read, You know, first and foremost, as a sailor, you know, at sea, there's a lot of time to read, frankly, even though you're standing watch, you're running around. In the case of this wonderful medical community, you're seeing patients, you're ensuring everyone isn't coming down with COVID. You know, you're doing all the hard work you do at sea. But even so, there's pockets and corners of time when you can stop and pull that book out. And I think even when you're on shore duty, and you're traveling in the airplane, you know, as opposed to watching a movie, you know, take your book, read. You just have to kind of organize. And then, and lastly, prioritize. And what I mean by that is have a structure to your reading every week. And what I try and do, I make a point of reading one fiction, one nonfiction book, kind of at the same time. And, you know, I'll go back and forth. Maybe that doesn't work for everybody, but having two books going, one fiction, nonfiction, I think is a good structure. And in terms of priority, I use the review services. So I look at the New York Times book review and look at reviews in Time Magazine and other sources. And I kind of jot down books that I'm interested in, and I prioritize to read what matters the most to me. And for me, I like that balance of fiction and nonfiction. So a few thoughts to get our conversation started, Admiral. How about you? What's your strategy?
Yeah, I'm very much the same way. I realize that there are, you rarely have the chance to carve out a couple of hours at a time, but I do get up early in the morning. I do find that's a nice way to start the day is to have a book going. Sometimes, unfortunately, that's things I need to read for work and to get ready for the day. But majority of the time, it's discretionary reading. I also interestingly follow the fiction nonfiction. I find that's a nice way to go. Most of the fiction I tend to read before bed. Of the nonfiction, since it tends to be a little more technical, I read when I'm a little more alert. So
same here.
That's what I do. I was interested to read that Stephen King, the great novelist, you know, there was a description of him standing in line for a movie and he had a book with him while he was waiting in line. And I think, you know, maybe.
Hey, I'll tell you, honestly, I will stand in the line at Whole Foods and just open up my iPhone, go to my Kindle, and you know, I find this may be counterintuitive to folks. I find it very fast to read on an iPhone because it's a small screen. You can just kind of absorb and keep moving and flick, 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 and it just it beats, you know, looking at the covers of the movie magazines.
That's right. The other place is, of course, airplanes, because you're locked in. You've got a defined amount of time, and it's amazing just in the amount of time it takes to load the airplane, how much I can read. So that's great. Sounds like we're kindred souls there. For the Sailor's Bookshelf, and I'll just hold this up so everybody can see a beautiful cover, and published by the Naval Institute Press, with whom you've published, I think, seven books.
I've done seven with them and four with Penguin Press Random House. And it's an interesting split because Penguin Press Random House is the largest publisher in the world. And Naval Institute is very much an academic house, relatively small, publishes maybe 60, maybe 70 titles in a year. The only big blockbuster, by the way, I don't know if folks know this, but their big blockbuster was The Hunt for Red October. Yeah, right. You knew that. They had only published, you know, books about the Battle of Trafalgar and, you know, the Watch Officer's Guide. And then this guy, Tom Clancy, had Hunt for Red October was rejected by 40 different publishers. The Naval Institute became the publisher of last resort. And of course, it became an enormous bestseller and launched Tom Clancy on his career.
Well, that's fascinating. So for this particular book, you've organized it into four areas. So you've got the oceans, explorers, sailors in fiction, and sailors in nonfiction. I wonder if you could just maybe elaborate on, you know, given the, pardon the pun, the ocean of books available, out there pertaining to the sea, particularly given the breadth of, you could have probably easily written, you know, characterized 50 books just on the Navy.
Yeah.
So how'd you come up with that strategy, and then how did you kind of work through your library to decide?
Yeah, I wish I had a more scientific answer for you, but here's what I did. And not everybody is quite as much of a bibliophile, a lover of books, as I am, but I have about 5,000 books, and about 1,500 of my books are nautical. And they're organized in one particular section of my home, the nautical books, the 1,500 books. And so what I did was quite simply go over those shelves and pull out, okay, that book meant a lot to me. And it was something I was reading when I was the XO of the Antietam, the cruiser. And that particular book that I'm talking about is 100 Days, about the Battle of the Falklands. And by Sir Sandy Woodard. And so I'd take that book and put it on a stack, and probably out of the 1,500 books, I ended up with about 150 that were truly meaningful to me. Had when I looked at the book, I remembered it vividly, and I could place myself reading Patrick O'Brien's novels about Jack Aubrey and Stephen Maturin while I was the captain of the Barry, you know, and I read all of them, all the ones that were published, the first 17 as the captain of the Barry over 2.5 years. And I'd sit in the bridge wing chair reading those books. And by the way, those dog-eared paperback copies got passed around among the wardroom, and pretty soon everybody was reading them and talking about them. And in any event, so I ended up with 150 books. And that's when I got to the categories, you know, okay, how am I going to structure this? Hence the categories, which seem pretty natural and pretty balanced in terms of talking about the physical aspects of the ocean itself and how to navigate and drive ships and almost the tools of the trade. Explorers is just always going to be a maritime category on its own, and such a rich, wonderful category. In fact, in this week's New York Times book review section, you saw it, is a new, I think, going to be really terrific biography of Ernest Shackleton, written by Ranulf Fiennes, who himself is an epic explorer. So I'm looking forward to that. And anyway, explorers was a pretty obvious, because there were so many books about explorers. And I think all of us who go down to the sea in ships love that whole aspect of it. And then literature of the sea is really the other two categories. And so that I just broke into fiction and nonfiction. And those are pretty broad, obviously. I'll close on this by saying the one of the seminal courses I've ever taken in my life was my youngster year at the Naval Academy, sophomore year. I took Literature of the Sea, which I think is still taught at the Naval Academy. And it's a kind of a combined fiction, nonfiction. It's what got the idea percolating, you know, when I was at the Naval Academy in the 1970s, otherwise known as 1.2 million years ago. but you could drop a plumb line from taking that course to the idea of the sailor's bookshelf.
Well, that's fantastic. And it does remind me and tell the audience that we're going to be interested in your feedback in terms of what books are not on the list that you think ought to have been. I know that Admiral Stavridis, at the end of your book, you actually asked for that input and provide an email address. I'd also ask for extra bonus credit given the Navy Medicine aspect of this is for folks to recommend books that have to do with medicine at sea in some regard. And if it's Navy medicine at sea, that's extra credit. So it's interesting. I did the review of the new book about Shackleton did catch my eye this weekend, and as I read the review, it struck me that he's held in highest regard, Shackleton, that is, as a leader, because of how he took care of his crew. But if you look at all four of the voyages that he was part of, he was not successful, and so. So it's interesting to me that somebody that we admire It really speaks to our values, I guess, in terms of the role of a leader. Could you expand a little bit on that topic?
I can. First, I'll make the observation that I think all of us learn a lot about leadership from our failures. And certainly that was the case for me when I was the CEO of the Berry, first command at sea. You know, we were doing great and winning all kinds of awards. That was about a year, year and a half into the tour. And I freely admit my hat size was kind of expanding. I was feeling like, man, we're bulletproof. And then we had to take a big engineering exam, a PEB, Propulsion Examining Board. It's the standard once a year engineering inspection every ship in the Navy takes. And without dragging you through all the puts and takes of it, we failed it. We failed it miserably. And we failed it so badly, we were out at sea going through the drills and the PEB declared the ship unsafe to sail. And they towed us back into port. I'm not making this up.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, you know, we finally got alongside the pier. And by the way, they towed us by every pier in San Diego. So all of my contemporaries, all of the sailors, everybody saw Barry towed back in from its big engineering inspection. And so I went home that night and I told my wife, you know, it's all over. My career is over. Tomorrow morning, the Commodore is going to come down to the Berry and he's going to fire me. And I know that because that's what I would do if I were the Commodore. So Laura and I had a big cry about it. You know, fortunately, I was close to 20 and I figured, out of the Navy and I'll do other things in my life. And, you know, that's the way it is. The next day, here's the lessons. The Commodore came down and he didn't fire me. And he, you know, he kind of chewed me out in his way. And he said to me, but, you know, we see potential in you as a commander and you know, a lot of good things were happening before this. We'll give you another chance. You're not going to get the Battle E. You're not going to get the Red E, but we'll give you a chance in 30 days to try again. And so I got a second chance. That's a real lesson. Number two, you know, you always think about after an experience like that, you'll go down and sort of be pumping up your sailors. And it was the other way around. The sailors came up to me and would say, it's okay, Captain. You know, we got this. We're gonna do this right. I mean, it was very, very moving for me. And the third thing, another big lesson here was my contemporaries, my peers, the other destroyer captains in particular, but really all the COs on the waterfront that I knew, called me up that day and said, hey, really bad day, you know, towed into port. But they said, what do you need? Do you need parts? Do you need training? Do you need my master chief to come down and help? What can we do? And I think the lessons there are pretty obvious, but one I'll just draw a line under, because I think it's really true in medicine, right? And I'd ask you to comment on this, Admiral, but, you know, we are kind of underweight, most of us, in thinking about our peers. In other words, we spend a lot of time trying to impress our boss. That's human nature. I think most people have figured out, you know, take care of the people who are working for you. But taking care of those peer relationships, I think, can be very, very important. And I would think that's a particular note in medicine, is it not?
It really is, particularly during COVID.
Yeah.
I think we've really seen folks really tired and frankly, a bit frustrated that there is a solution to the problem, but not everybody will avail themselves of it.
It's amazing. So
I think, yeah, absolutely. I think particularly as an orthopedic surgeon, you know, during difficult cases, being able to call in a colleague who may have a different experience or perspective on how to proceed certainly was very valuable throughout my career. And it's interesting. I think your comments are particularly timely given the CNO's, initiative to quote, get real, get better. In the sense that you know, we can't deal with each failure episodically. We have to look at the underlying causes and the systemic causes. And we certainly believe that in medicine.
And And just to add to that, going back to Ernest Shackleton, you know, I think he learned from these failures. And yeah, his individual cruises and explorations didn't accomplish the uber objective of each of them. But yet, particularly the story of the Endurance, where he sails this vessel down. And one of the books on the sailor's bookshelf is Endurance, it's called, by Carolyn Alexander. You know, his ship literally is crushed in the ice floes of Antarctica. He treks his sailors across to get to a different part. And then he conducts the greatest voyage of his life in a small boat with a handful of his sailors. They traverse 1,500 miles of ocean. It's one of the great small boat sailing episodes in history, rivaling that of Captain Bligh and the ill-fated voyage of the when he was deposed and thrown off the Bounty. And so he made it and got to relief, and they came back and rescued all of his sailors. And I would argue, again, what he learned from his failures was determination, resilience, taking care of your people. Your peer relationships matter. You see that again and again in Ernest Shackleton's life.
Yeah, that is inspiring. And I'll confess, I wasn't as clear on Bly's experience, but I appreciated your description of it in the book.
It's an amazing voyage. Again, as most folks know, mutiny on the Bounty. Bounty is the ship, and a mutiny occurs. And this captain, who is Bly, who is, you know, kind of a harsh taskmaster and despised by many in his wardroom and his crew, but he is one hell of a navigator, one hell of a sailor, and a strong leader and personality. And he sails 1,700 miles from the open ocean, essentially, to a Dutch colony where he brings all of his sailors home. So a lot of parallels in the two. Shackleton is a much better, we would say, servant leader. Mm-hmm. Bly is more of that toxic but highly competent leader. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, those two things do sometimes go hand in hand. I want to be in the Endurance with Ernest Shackleton, not the Bounty with Captain Bly.
Absolutely. And I guess the third piece would be Thor Heyerdahl and you know, that landmark voyage to prove a scientific point.
Yeah. No, this is the voyage of Kon-Tiki. And what he wanted to prove was that the ancient Polynesian navigators could have discovered the Americas well before Columbus. And the way he proved it was to construct a raft, Kon-Tiki was the name of it, using only the technology available to Polynesian mariners of like 3,000 years ago. And then he and a small crew sailed this thing from the coast of South America back to the island from which he hypothesized they departed. Again, an incredible act of seamanship and a pretty powerful one. I do want to go to another book that this is making me think about, if I can, Admiral, and it's
of course
The Kane Mutiny Court-Martial, because this is a book about a very toxic leader who is the captain of USS Kane, a small minesweeper in the Second World War. This is a fantastic movie, by the way, with Humphrey Bogart playing the lead captain, and Fred McMurray is in it as one of the junior officers. It's really an extraordinary story. It's written by Herman Woke, based on experiences he had in the Second World War as a junior officer. And on the surface, it's a story of a toxic leader in a mutiny, effectively, when his executive officer relieves him for cause because of incompetence in the face of a huge hurricane. But then the court-martial, which is what the story really is about, is very nuanced. And it's a book about what followers owe leaders. How far does your loyalty have to go? What is annoying and disturbing in the case of a leader? And what causes you to finally break with that leader? And it's not a simple equation as it's often depicted. And it brings us back to Captain Bligh, which again brings us back to the captain you really want to sail with, which is Ernest Shackleton.
That's neat. And then, so that's a nice segue, I guess, into fiction, in that, you know, you, in your discussion with Captain Ned Beach, you know, he mentioned how important he thought the book 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea was, since it was the first book about a submarine captain. And so how well do you think lessons from fiction like that translate to, say, those who are out there operationally?
I think they translate extremely well. And when I get to know a leader, be it when I was a junior officer looking up to a lieutenant, lieutenant commander, department head, or being a four-star admiral looking at my contemporaries and peers, or looking at two-star, one-star admirals who are part of my team, invariably, I found that those who read voraciously, love books and want to talk about them, and in my view, in particular, have some portion of their reading diet is fiction, those are the folks you want to be around. And I'll tell you why I think fiction is so important. Number one, it's a simulator. You get put yourself in the book and imagine what you would do in those circumstances. So we were talking before we kicked off about Patrick O'Brien and the 20-volume series on Jack Aubrey and Stephen Maturin. It's one long meditation on leadership at times under extreme stress and combat. And as you read those books, you put yourself in that situation, in that simulator. And by the way, to Navy medicine, you know, the co-host of the series, so to speak, is Dr. Right. Stephen Maturin, who's a real physician during a period of time when most ships had, no offense, Surgeon General, just surgeons, which right. in those days were really barbers who came into the boat. And whereas Maturin was a true physician, like the professionals on this call. And so I think those books, by the way, have a lot of medicine in them, including a famous trepanning, am I saying that right? Where yep. Maturin puts, hammers out a shilling and puts it in somebody's head. This is in the early 19th century. So the whole idea of reading fiction, first, it's a simulator. And then secondly, it's a wonderful way to learn about history. If you read, again, using those books as an example, the history of the Napoleonic Wars just comes alive for you. Kay Mutiny Court-Martial, we talked about the U.S. Navy in the Second World War. Another great book from that period, by the way, is Mr. Roberts by Thomas Hesser, about a junior officer who's revered by his crew, again, a toxic leader, captain, and how he handles it, how Mr. Roberts handles it. But the point is, history, you get that context of history and fiction, I think is very, very important. And then thirdly, you know, newsflash, fiction is entertaining. It's relaxing. You can step outside yourself and find yourself in a different time, a different place, a different set of circumstances. It refreshes you and prepares you for the next hard thing you've got to do.
Well, that's great. Yeah. And I just as a side note, yeah, Stephen Maturin is one of my favorites because he is not only a physician aboard ship, but he's really a Renaissance man.
Exactly.
In the width of breadth of his interests. Although I'll leave aside the part about being the spy.
Yes. It's very funny, the two of them, because, Captain Jack Aubrey is this big, bluff, British sea captain who is a master at sea, you know, knows every rope, every line, every gun. He's a consummate leader. His crew loves him. He's a master at sea. But every time he goes ashore, he proves to be a total boob. You know, he gets entrapped by swindlers. He has all kinds of problems with his estate, his money, you know, master at sea, just a boob ashore. Maturin is the other way around. Maturin doesn't know the fantail from the forecastle, but he is a master of the medical craft and saves the lives and becomes beloved of the crews on each of these ships. But when Mattern goes ashore, your point, expert shot, deadly duelist, spy, speaks half a dozen languages, elegant, dangerous. It's a perfect yin and yang. And there's a lot to like and admire about Stephen Mattern, Dr. Stephen Mattern.
I will say the appendectomy ashore that performed by himself in the movie, it was probably one of the more graphic
on himself. Yeah, on exactly.
Scenes that I can remember. As I went through the list, I was familiar with almost all of the books. Some of the technical ones, not having gone to the Naval Academy, I appreciated learning about, but haven't read. But the one that stood out is one that was a complete black hole to me was the Bedford Incident.
Yeah,
and I was fascinated to know what influence it had on you deciding on your choice of career. And I wonder if you could enlighten us about that.
I can. The Bedford Incident, the name Bedford is USS Bedford, and it's a guided missile destroyer during the Cold War, at the height of the Cold War. It's operating in the North Atlantic, kind of off the coast of Greenland, in the Greenland-Iceland-UK gap. And the captain is very ambitious, but he's ruthlessly efficient, a master of his highly technical steel destroyer. And he is also someone who is obsessed with finding this Russian submarine that is operating up there. It's a clear homage to Moby Dick. And so here you have the captain of the Bedford seeking out and finding this Russian submarine in an episode up there that could easily have sparked a world war. And it was influential to me because it was the first book that I read about destroyers, about that class of ship and their capabilities and their frontline aspects. And after I read it, I knew I wanted not only to be a naval officer, but a Navy officer and a destroyer officer. And so I was lucky enough to fulfill that ambition. And it began by reading that novel as a teenager. And I highly commend the book. I mean, it's a tense page turner. It's an excellent film. An old-time actor named Richard Widmark played the captain. But here's a little known fact. The other protagonist, who's a journalist assigned to the USS Bedford, is played by Sidney Poitier, one of the great African-American Oscar-winning actors. And by the way, the role has nothing to do with being black. He's a reporter. And it's a masterful performance by Sidney Poitier. Really, the film is great. The novel, even better.
Great. Well, I ordered it this morning, so
you'll like it. Tell me what you think of it.
Okay, I will.
And by the way, can I say one other thing? The novel was very much in my mind as I was writing my last book, which I think we talked about last time, 2034. A novel of the next world war, which is about a war between the U.S. and China that is sparked by a collision, an attack on U.S. destroyers in the South China Sea. And there were echoes of the Bedford incident playing along in my mind as I parked the opening scenario of 2034 in that book. I was thinking of the Bedford incident.
That's great. Well, it does. I think we spoke after, and you mentioned that there may be sequels to 2034. Can you give us a little insight there?
I can. There are two sequels to 2034 that are coming along. 2034, as those of you who have read the novel know, is about a war between the U.S. and China set, obviously, in the year 2034. The next book, 2054, which my co-author and I are very close to completing, and thus it'll be out in about a year from now, is 2054. So it's set in the year 2054, and it deals with artificial intelligence, cyber. So first novel, 2034, China. Second novel, 2054, artificial intelligence, which I think by mid-century will be one of the great ethical, moral challenges we face as a species. And then the third book in that trilogy, which is contracted for and we'll begin writing as soon as we're done with 2054, the third book is set in 2074, and it's about climate and the impact of climate change. And all three of these books are cautionary tales about what could happen if we don't, in the case of China, avoid a war, if we don't, in the case of artificial intelligence, ensure that the human spirit continues to drive our choices, and what could happen in 2074 if we fail to address climate sufficiently. That may be the greatest challenge of all.
Great. Well, two more reasons why we need to become even more efficient readers. Does Sarah Hunt leave her farm in New Mexico, or is she retired?
Sarah Hunt does leave her farm in New Mexico and plays a central role in the second book, as does Sarah Hunt's daughter. You recall at the end of 2034, she's reaching for the telephone, about to get the news whether or not she'll be allowed to adopt. It turns out she does become a mother through adoption. She adopts a little Mexican girl, and that girl grows to be a woman in 2054, and both she and her mother have a central role in what unfolds.
Oh, great. Well, I'll look forward to that. Let me ask my moderators if we've got some questions from the field. It looks like we do, so I don't want to monopolize this. So the first question is from Michael Jaconis, and he says, have you read James Fenimore Cooper's Afloat and Ashore? And if so, what are your thoughts?
I have not read it. It may surprise some readers to know that James Fenimore Cooper wrote several novels that are set at sea, a couple of which I've read, but I have not read that one. I will add it to my assignments. And by the way, anybody who's listening, if you have ideas like that of books that you think I should read and think about in terms of the next volume of The Sailor's Bookshelf, and there will be a second volume of The Sailor's Bookshelf, please feed those to me, and I will gladly take that recommendation. But again, James Fenimore Cooper, who is better known for writing the Leather Stocking Tales, the Last of the Mohicans,
right,
you know, kind of shore-bound novels, actually wrote several novels of the sea, several of which, as I said, are quite good. I don't know that one. Afloat and Ashore, I will get it and read it.
Okay, great. Well then, so since we know you will have a second volume, I'll tell you my bias. And I was surprised, given your Greek heritage, that the Odyssey was not part of the bookshelf.
I think that it's got to get a place in the second. If you really think about the Odyssey, it is obviously a story of a voyage, and it's Ulysses or Odysseus, as the Greeks call him, hence the word the Odyssey, his voyage returning from Troy to get back to Ithaca, his home island, where waiting for him is his faithful wife, Penelope. My basset hound, by the way, is named Penelope after after Odysseus's wife. And I think it's a good fit, but I'll tell you why I didn't put it on there. And same reason I did not include The Tempest by Shakespeare. It's that all the action occurs ashore. There are no sea battles in the Odyssey. There are some storms that blow him ashore. So he gets to the next stop and encounters the witch, Circe. But the action is ashore, both in that and also in The Tempest, even though Shakespeare's The Tempest, I think, arguably could be in a book about the sea because it's a great storm. But what I tried to do in the books, the novels, I was looking for things that had action actually at sea. But the Odyssey definitely will be in volume two. I make a public pledge of that.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'm sure Homer will be pleased.
He will.
All right, we've got a listener who is going to put you on the spot. So this is from Sean Shilliday, And it's, what is your favorite fiction and nonfiction of all time? So we're, I think we're being allowed to step outside the nautical theme and get your thoughts on that.
Yeah. A hard question for someone like me to answer, as you can tell. But I'll tell you a book, one fiction and one nonfiction, books that I have reread many, many times. And neither of them, interestingly, are nautical. The novel that I have read again and again and again is by Ernest Hemingway. And, you know, I pause there because I also love The Old Man and the Sea, which is on this reading list. But I think the greatest of his novels, and one of the great American novels, is The Sun Also Rises, which is about the generation of expatriates in Europe at the end of the First World War. It's just so beautifully written, and the fit and finish of the novel is so remarkable. And the settings, which move from Paris in the 20s to the Pyrenees Mountains, where he's fly fishing, down to the real set piece, which is the big fiesta, the running of the bulls in Pamplona. And then it concludes in Madrid. It's just a marvelous novel, and I've read it too many times to count. It's short and kind of easily readable. In terms of a nonfiction, I wouldn't say it's really my absolute favorite. And I'll tell you a nautical nonfiction book that I dip into a lot is that old classic Sea Power by E.B. Potter, which was the textbook from which I studied as a midshipman. And so often I'm reading a book about the sea or working on the sailor's bookshelf, and I'll dive into Sea Power, which goes all the way back to the ancient Greeks and Romans. And so if you really want a nautical nonfiction book, that's a classic. I think Sea Power is up there. The book nonfiction that I love and have read again and again and kind of dip in and out of is Winston Churchill's The Second World War. It's 6 volumes, but it's just so perfectly written. And of course, he won a Nobel Prize in literature, well-deserved, as did Hemingway. And it obviously tells the story of the Second World War, but talk about resilience and emotional intelligence and strategy and alliances and the sweep of history and the sense of everything's going to fail and then you triumph in the end. I mean, it's a remarkable book, although, again, it's 6 books. And I'll tell you, when I'm locked up trying to write something, if I'm just having phrasing or just as we all do, I'll just pull a volume of that out and just randomly open it and just read a couple of passages. And it just unlocks the writing process for me. Similarly, and just a tiny click below that, again, it's an investment in time to read it, but it's Gibbon's The Fall of the Roman Empire. I think it's very close to Churchillian in its prose. And of course, both of them, both Gibbons and Churchill, you can drop a plumb line statistically from the King James Bible, you know, the old King James Bible. That is where a lot of that phrasing and pacing comes from. It also kind of rattles around in Hemingway's head as well. So again, Hemingway, the Sun Also Rises, and Churchill, The Second World War. Those would be my 2 all-time faves.
All right, great. Good question. What a gifted orator, but also writer. I don't know if people recognize, you know, what a great writer he was, most of which he would dictate, as I understand it.
Absolutely correct. And if you don't want to invest in the 6 volumes, a much shorter book by him is his very first or second book, I think maybe second book. It's called My Early Years, My Early Years. Subtitle is A Roving Commission, and it's autobiography of him from age 0 to about age 33, 35. Mm-hmm. And, you know, who's presumptuous enough to write an autobiography at age 33, Winston Churchill. He never lacked for self-confidence. But if you really look at what's in it, it's extraordinary. I mean, he goes to Sandhurst, he goes to India, he fights in Afghanistan. He goes to Cuba. He's involved in the war there, the Spanish as an observer for the Brits. He ends up in a campaign in the Sudan, fighting the Mahdi, the Islamic jihadists of the day, going back to avenge the death of General Gordon. It's a pretty packed 33 years, and it's highly readable and a lot shorter than plowing through the six volumes. My Early Years by Winston Churchill.
Oh, very good. Just some recommendations, and if you care to comment, that'd be great. But so far we've gotten from Mike Rode, who recommends the Horatio Hornblower series by Forrester.
Right.
A more recent recommendation, The Unknowns by P. O'Donnell, which is the recovery of the after the First World War of unknown servicemen who had died overseas, and then choosing one to represent all of them that are now entombed in the monument there. And then a more medical specific, this is from Captain Emery Moore, who's a member here of the staff at BUMED, The Ship's Medicine Chest and Medical Aid at Sea. So a little more practical recommendation. And it's published by the Department of Health and Human Services, interestingly.
That sounds like a good one, actually. Given that, as the Surgeon General knows, I have a daughter, former Navy nurse, now a nurse practitioner, Georgetown undergrad, Duke. And then I have two son-in-laws who are both physicians. One, colleague of this audience, Lieutenant Commander Scott Wallace, doing his residency at Bethesda. Deployed with the Marines before, worked in the Pentagon and John Baxter's clinic over there. So my other son-in-law is an emergency room physician, and I will get him a copy of The Ship's Medicine Chest for Christmas. I think he'll get a kick out of that. I don't know The Unknowns, but it sounds intriguing. I will look into that. Let me park on Hornblower for a minute. I love the Hornblower series. I think it's beautifully crafted. C.S. Forster, who wrote it, appears on this list in the form of the book The Good Shepherd, which is a single volume about, and many of you may have seen the film that just came out with Tom Hanks as the captain of a destroyer in World War II. The Good Shepherd of the title is the captain. He's the good shepherd to this destroyer conducting anti-submarine patrols on convoys. It's a fantastic film, and the book is just a beautifully realized study of command at sea under extreme pressure in combat. So as I came down to the Sailor's bookshelf, you know, I've got Patrick O'Brien on there, and that's, you know, 20 volumes, a story of a British sea officer. It really came down to one or the other. And because I wanted to include C.S. Forster, I went with Patrick O'Brien. I will definitely have Hornblower in volume two. The books are very, very good and can be read. And I think, unlike O'Brien, you really have to be kind of a mature adult to read O'Brien. He's complicated and psychological. He's kind of Jane Austen goes to sea. Hornblower can be read quite happily by a 14-year-old. And I mean that as a compliment. It's written simply. You get the big ideas of character and adventure. And Hornblower himself, Horatio Hornblower, the title character, has an endearing kind of lack of self-confidence. You know, he is someone who is complicated and has his dark corners. And I think C.S. Forster brings those out quite well. Having said all that, the other reason I had to go with Patrick O'Brien is there's a doctor in it. There's a physician here in Patrick O'Brien, whereas Hornblower is, you know, it's got some surgeons that come in and out. So point taken, volume two, it'll be there.
All right. Appreciate that. you know, from my perspective, when I actually look back on the list of books that I've read, and I look particularly for those that had a nautical theme, one of the ones when I was the surgeon out at Pacific Fleet was given to me by the commander at the time was Nimitz by E.B.
Yep.
Potter.
Yep.
Who I know you had the great fortune to have as one of your instructors at the academy. I think the reason that that one stands out, is what a tremendous leader Nimitz was, absolutely the right man for the job at the time. But it's a twofer in that alternating chapters tell you the story of the Pacific War and World War II. Was that a consideration for this
absolutely.
Book?
Absolutely. And as you look at that group of World War II admirals, Potter, who was, as you mentioned, was my professor in his senior years when I was a fourth class midshipman, a plebe at the academy, a freshman. E.B. Potter wrote biographies not only of Nimitz, with whom, by the way, he was personally very, very close. And in fact, they co-authored the book we were talking about a moment ago, Sea Power. That is co-authored by E.B. Potter and Fleet Admiral Chester Nimitz, five-star admiral, by the way. So I looked at that of Nimitz. I looked at E.B. Potter's Arleigh Burke. He wrote one on Arleigh Burke, the greatest destroyer officer in history. And he did one on Halsey. And I think I could have included any of those. I'm also a big fan of Thomas Buell in terms of biographies. As you know, Surgeon General, Buell wrote Master of Sea Power about Ernest King, Fleet Admiral Ernest King. And then he wrote The Quiet Warrior about Raymond Spruance, who I think got robbed in the sense that, you know, we should all do so badly to retire as a four-star officer, which he was. He should have been a five-star.
Right.
Spruance absolutely should have been a fleet admiral, and I think was a better officer, a better warfighter, a better leader than Halsey. But Halsey, because of his flamboyance and his persona, just got the public relations push, if you will. Anyway, I'm enormous fan of all of those admirals, and they're all kind of in my mind right now because, as we were talking about, Surgeon General, my next novel, which I've just contracted with Penguin Press, Random House, is a working title is For Those in Peril, and it is a story of an American naval officer. Starts as he graduates from Annapolis in 1941. It's historical fiction, which will follow him through a 50-year career starting in 1941 to 1991. Think about that sweep for a few minutes. And so as a result, I'm writing right now the detailed outline of the first volume of that. And so I'm working very hard to get through all of these biographies. Yeah, I think on volume two, we'll see a couple of those admirals appear probably in the versions written by E.B. Potter. But boy, do I like that Thomas Buell, The Quiet Warrior, Raymond Spruance.
Yeah, I enjoyed that as well. And one more plug would just to consider Woke's other books, particularly Winds of War, which I really at probably in college helped me understand everything that was occurring in World War II.
100% correct. And it's funny you say that because I'm literally rereading those books right now, again, in preparation to write this historical fiction. And as most folks here probably know, together, those two books, Winds of War, War and Remembrance, well over 1,000 pages. And they follow a fictional family, Captain Pug Henry, his kind of flighty wife, Rhoda, and his two sons, Warren and Byron. Warren becomes a fighter pilot, and Byron becomes a submariner. And so, and Pug Henry is a surface officer, but a battleship officer. And so you really do get the Navy and all the characters we just talked about. I'm just reading a section now where Pug Henry is called up to meet with Halsey. And, you know, it's just they're also perfectly realized. And it's its own kind of Jacobean drama, the Second World War Navy in the Pacific. And yeah, I think of the two, and I'd be curious which one you enjoyed more. I liked I really liked the first one more, Winds of War, as a work of fiction, but it really runs from 1936 to 1941. It really stops at the attack on Pearl Harbor. The second one, War and Remembrance, I think is perhaps not quite as well crafted, but really covers the parts you would want the war in the Pacific. What are your thoughts as between the two volumes?
Actually, now that you mention that, you're right. I mean, Puck Henry spends most of his time in Europe in the first one. And so I think you're right. I just felt to understand what led to World War II, that was such a great book.
100%.
So unfortunately, we're almost out of time, and so I've got one more question from one of our viewers. This is Aaron Werbel, who's the executive officer out at Naval Hospital 29 Palms. What are your thoughts on Tracks in the Sea, Matthew Fontaine Maury, and the Mapping of the Oceans?
It is a brilliant book, and I intend to give it serious consideration for the next volume. And I think what I like about it is it brings together the oceans with science. And, you know, I think oceanography is hit in a couple of places in the book, in the Leader's Bookshelf, but deserves a little higher bump in the trajectory. So we'll give that a second. Doc, if I could, can I conclude with just a word about Moby Dick?
Yes, thank you. That was my next question. So
yeah. Oh, perfect. Great minds think alike. You know, Moby Dick's a hard book and it's a long book, but if you talk to any scholar of American literature, you will hear again and again, it's the greatest American novel. And it's truly a book about the sea. And here's my advice, read it, but don't feel like you have to read every page. Read it and follow the plot line. There are sections of it that are just excruciating detail on how to kill a sperm whale. You don't need to, you know, keep moving through the book. But the arc of the story, beginning in a tavern in New Bedford in New England, with our narrator Ishmael signing up to go to sea and become a whaler and meeting Queequeg the harpooner, and then they get into the Pequod, which is the ship. And by the way, every single day you encounter Moby Dick, because I bet you go by a Starbucks.
Yeah.
And if you look at the logo on Starbucks, he's the mate in the Pequod. And that was what Starbucks is named after. But the book is about shipmates. It's about the challenges of the sea, kind of represented by this rogue whale. It's about ambition and obsession. It's about friendship. It is full of lessons for sailors and full of lessons for life. I'd highly, highly recommend it as part of your sailor's bookshelf.
Oh, that's great, Admiral Stavridis. Thank you. And I will say, I did pick up Nathaniel Philbrick's, I think, wrote a small volume on
In the Heart of the Sea. It's called In the Heart of the Sea. Yeah, it's terrific. It's the true story of the Moby Dick episode. It is well worth reading right alongside Moby Dick.
Well, it's great. Well, sir, thank you so much for your time today. It went much too fast.
Yeah.
I know that there were other questions folks had for you, but I offer, as you did and in the book, to email you directly with suggestions. And I look forward to your next projects coming out, and I look forward to our future discussions on those.
My pleasure, Surgeon General. It's an honor to be with the Navy medical community. Thank you, sir.
You know, thank you again. We're out here.